Good afternoon and welcome to your own health and fitness talk show. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm here live with you every Tuesday at 2 p.m. talking to you about healthcare. Sometimes I talk to you about exercise, and I normally take your phone calls to let you participate in the show. Well, as you may know, those of you who listen to your Pacifica station on a regular basis, we're in a fund drive, so rather than take your calls to have you ask questions and participate in the interview, what I am going to do is hope that you will call during this hour to join your Pacifica station and get a copy of the book that we'll be discussing today as a premium, a thank you gift. I'm going to be interviewing today Stanford biology and neuroscience professor Robert Sapolsky, author of the book that we have today, The Trouble with Testosterone and Other Essays on the Biology of the Human Predicament. And as we go along, there'll be a brief musical break at the half hour, and then at the 45, I will hope that you will begin in earnest to call in and get a copy of this fabulous book of essays on why we perform and act and feel the way we do from a biological standpoint. Very humorous book. This is the same author who wrote Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. So if you're in the Bay Area and you want to pledge and get a copy of The Trouble with Testosterone with a membership to KPFA as a thank you gift, you will call 510-848-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. If you're in the Los Angeles, Southern California area and you're listening to KPFK, you can dial in at 818-985-5735, which is 1-81985-KPFK. A reminder, if you need to get a copy of today's show or if you need more information, you can call my information number at 707-769-1458 during normal business hours. Dr. Sapolsky, are you in fact with us?
Yes, indeed.
You are there. A brief introduction. A native of New York City, Robert Sapolsky, I should say Dr. Robert Sapolsky, holds degrees from Harvard and Rockefeller Universities. He's currently professor of biology and neuroscience at Stanford University, and his previous book, which we discussed on the show about a month or so ago, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. In 1987, he was awarded a MacArthur Grant Foundation, which is the genius grant, so you better perform well today, Dr. Sapolsky, a regular contributor to Discover and the Sciences. He lives with his family in Stanford, California. So a very great welcome to you. I always welcome this opportunity to be able to talk to you about this stuff. I love this.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, goody. This book is a little different from Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. In this book, you have a whole series of essays that are quite entertaining and very funny, where you explore an understanding of our behavior patterns based both on neuroscience, biology, and in fact also your own study of baboons in Africa, using them, since they're cousins, as models to look at us as a species and what makes us tick. And I'm wondering whether you think that the predicament, as you say in your book, the human predicament, the biology of the human predicament, has to do with our larger frontal lobe.
I'd say it's a combination of our frontal lobe being a lot larger than in most other species and how often at critical junctures we wind up not getting much advantage of having a larger frontal lobe. In sort of his introduction for people, you know, one of the distinctive things that makes the human brain so different from primate brains is we've got this thing called the frontal cortex. We've got a lot more of it than anybody out there. And this is the part of the brain that makes us human in a very recognizable way. This is the part of the brain that gives us self-control, that has something to do with regulating impulsive behaviors. At the most mundane level, this is the part of the brain that makes you say you loved somebody's dinner when you think it's the most, you know, repulsive thing you've ever eaten, and to compliment somebody's new hairdo. And at another extreme, it's a part of the brain that has a lot to do with why some of us think murderous things and why some of us actually do murderous things. And individual differences in how this part of the brain works has an awful lot to do, I suspect, with some of the world's ills.
Yeah, and what you call it in the book, the closest thing that we have to a super ego. In other words, when there's damage to the frontal cortex, this inhibition that normal people have in social situations goes away, and it can really greatly change the personality of a person.
Absolutely, and that is a very well-recognized sort of neuropsychological syndrome. I mean, every day, every single one of us has some thought that is boastful or lustful or petulant or who knows what, and where we would die if anybody ever knew we were thinking that. And you damage a subsection of this frontal cortex, and every time you think one of those things, you say it. And that's mighty distinctive. And one of the striking things is, yeah, we can accept the extremes of this pretty easily, totally blow away this part of the brain due to a gunshot wound, some sort of stroke, whatever, and yes, this is a transformation of the person's personality. No doubt you and I and every listener out there who would count as neurologically normal differ in how many neurons we have there and how well they work and how well other parts of the brain listen to that part of the brain, and suddenly we're beginning to look at a biology of not them and their neurological abnormalities, but us and our individual differences that make us individuals.
That said, when you compare us to our animal cousins, there's a question of whether we're better off. I mean, one of the things that's interesting in your other book where you discuss stress is that we, in fact, have, along with our capacity to behave socially, which primates do too, they behave socially as well, we have sort of a conscious thing about, we have a conscience, I guess is what I should say, about what we do. We worry and we fret about what we do. And sometimes that makes us more effective as social animals, and sometimes there's a dark side to that. Because if we get too precise, where you're talking about sort of limbic versus cortex, you know, function, like you use our friend Kaczynski, who is in the news right now, as an example, where people become very precise in their thinking and they lose the passionate side. So there's this very delicate balance to us being different than animals that isn't always light. Sometimes it's dark.
Well, one of the things that a lot of the essays cover is what's our biological place in the animal kingdom. And some of the time, the shocking thing about humans is we're just like every other animal on the block. In ways that can really amaze people, we release odorants, these things called pheromones, signals between each other that cause women's ovulatory cycles to synchronize with each other. For example, and this is a shocking sort of novel finding in humans. It's called the Wellesley effect, named after Wellesley College, where women in the all-women's dorm there tend to synchronize their cycles by the end of their freshman year. And this has been known for decades in primates and rodents. What do you know? We're just like every other animal on the block. Some of the time, what's interesting about us is we've got the same physiology as any other animal on the block, but we use it in a way that's utterly novel, that's absolutely perplexing to any other mammal out there. And a classic example of that would be you can have two humans engaged in this very human ritual. They sit at a table. They engage in this practice where they don't make a whole lot of eye contact and they don't do much verbal behavior. And every now and then, one of them does nothing more taxing than pick up their hand and move a little piece of wood. And if these two people happen to be chess grandmasters, they're having the exact same physiology as somebody sprinting across the savannah.
Mm.
A massive, massive physiological demands then seen in during chess tournaments. And all they're doing is thinking.
Mm.
We as humans can do the exact same physiology as any other beast on the block, but we could just do it with thought. And then some of the time, what's distinctive about us as humans is we're doing things that have absolutely no precedence in the animal world. We use language. We have sex for non-procreational purposes. We intermix sex and violence in a certain pathologic subset of us humans. We do all sorts of stuff that's really very, very unprecedented out there in the animal world.
Well, and again, there's a real question mark about whether it's how to make a judgment about it. And I think one of the things that's nice about studying the science of it is that it removes it from the realm of judgment and puts it into a realm of, how much of this can become conscious, how much can we pay attention to what we're doing. Talking about this frontal cortex and what happens when it gets damaged, the other thing that's interesting is what happens when you have a tendency toward or a little bit of some kind of dysfunctional brain function. Dysfunctional brain function in the sense that it is colored by a condition. So I might ask you at this point why a little schizophrenia is probably a lot more fun than a little OCD.
Well, this is one of the most challenging issues in neuropsychiatry or whatever multisyllabic term you want to throw together. The whole notion, we're really good at understanding the biology of them and their diseases. And what we're understanding is the same exact stuff, writ small, explains why some of us can stand on a supermarket line that's moving slowly and fantasize about something going on in the National Enquirer. And it's probably not all that different of neurochemistry and not all that different of biology. The particular area that you bring up is one that's been a subject of speculation for 50, 60 years. There's a sort of cousin of schizophrenia that people have studied. Schizophrenia, massive, crippling psychiatric disease, incredibly tragic, a disease of enormous thought disorder, a disease of social isolation, a disease of complete dysfunction. Turns out there's a sort of younger cousin of schizophrenia, which is found disproportionately amongst relatives of schizophrenics, and it's called schizotypal personality disorder. And schizotypal is not something that gets you hospitalized. Schizotypalism is just a way of describing a subset of folks where something's a little bit off. These are not people who were socially completely disconnected, were living as hermits in the backwoods of Montana. These are people who prefer to be on their own. They take jobs as, you know, fire tower watchmen, they take jobs as movie theater projectionists, things of that sort. These are not people who are totally thought disordered, that they can't go from one sentence to the next without making sense. These are people, though, who believe in a little bit of odd stuff, and the term that's given is they tend towards metamagical thinking, you know, a very strong belief in paranormal things, in ESP, and science fiction and fantasy, and this is where people often get very upset, in fundamentalist religious interpretations of things. None of these are mental illnesses. You know, you can go to a Star Trek convention, and that's not a sign of a mental illness. You can consult an astrologer and still be the first lady, that sort of thing. These are very subtle sorts of problems. And there's a very interesting area of speculation in anthropology that goes back 60 years, which suggests in traditional human societies, schizotypals were the shamans. Schizotypals were the witch doctors and the medicine men and the medicine women, the people who were not totally, utterly thought disordered, but the people who get a little bit thought disordered at the right time during the rituals, the people who don't believe that they're possessed all the time, but the people who during a ritualistic full moon spend the night being a hyena or a wolf or whatever the belief system is in that particular culture. And unlike how we treat mentally ill people in our society, shamans were very powerful, very rewarded individuals in traditional human society. And the very radical notion that came out of these ideas back when is, don't think about schizophrenia being this horrendous genetic disorder that has to be explained evolutionarily. Think about shamanism and schizotypalism as being something that has an advantage in traditional human societies. And, you know, every now and then, evolutionarily, you can afford the third cousin who's a schizophrenic in order to keep a ready supply of shamans.
And it's a lot more fun than needing to wash your hands every minute.
Absolutely.
A lot more fun. Briefly, for those of you who may have just tuned in, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm doing a pledge drive show with author of The Trouble with Testosterone and other essays on the biology of the human predicament, Dr. Robert Sapolsky, and we are giving away copies of The Trouble with Testosterone with a very nice picture of Mighty Mouse on the front to people who become members of your Pacifica station. And the number to call if you're in Northern California to do that during the hour is 510-848-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Or in the Southern California area, it's 818-985-5735, which is 818-985-KPFK. So we're talking a bit about what makes us, what are the nuances that not only make us slightly different from our cousins, our animal cousins, although we are remarkably like them in the way that we're affected by our biology, the way women still tend to birth at night to avoid being eaten by predators and things like that, and the ways that we're different and what the differences, what happens to the differences when these differences have different shadings, like if somebody's a little skitsy, they're more maybe magical in a certain way. Let's talk a bit about hormones, since you brought them up right on the cover of the book. One of the things, well, we might as well go right to testosterone, because you've mentioned it in the title. Is there trouble with testosterone, do you think?
There's only one essay out of 15 or 16 there.
Yes, no, clearly.
About testosterone, but it's one that I definitely have sort of a political axe to grind about, and I think most careful behavioral endocrinologists do, which is there is trouble with testosterone, which is most people out there think this hormone's got a lot more to do with male aggression than it actually does. There's a tendency to view the fact that because on the average males are more aggressive than females, and on the average males have more testosterone than females do, and on the average if you experimentally remove somebody's testosterone with a well-timed removal of the testes there, that aggression goes down. That tells you something about testosterone and aggression on the average. But what a million studies have shown is nothing about this hormone is ever going to tell you why one guy is more likely to yell at a loved one than another, why one guy is going to be more likely to be a pain in the ass and pound on the desk of some poor receptionist somewhere than the next person when things are moving slowly. It doesn't explain much about individual differences within the normal realm. And that's one that's real hard for people to get, and unfortunately that's one that makes a big difference when we try to figure out how to explain violent behavior and what to do to make a world in which there's less of it. And there's a real tendency to get sort of a single bullet explanation: testosterone ain't it. Mm-hmm. A lot more subtle than that.
In fact, something that I might just throw in here is that when testosterone levels get low in men, actually there's a very important study that was done in Sweden by Jan Muller, about the fact that cardiovascular disease, incident of cardiovascular disease and high cholesterol go up when testosterone levels go down. So it's protective to the body to have enough of the right hormones in the right levels. What you did was you talked about what happens if you experiment with levels of testosterone to see whether part of the behavioral patterns in an animal or a human is based on social stuff versus how much testosterone. And I want to read a passage of the book because it made me laugh so much. I love it. You're talking about an experiment of taking in a hierarchical social order with these baboons, taking number three, who is down on the list, and giving him more testosterone to see what would happen. And you say, quote, none of this within the normal range stuff, inject a ton of it into him, way higher than you would normally see in a rhesus, oh, this is a rhesus monkey, give him enough testosterone to grow antlers and a beard on every neuron in his brain. And, no surprise, when you then check the behavioral pattern, it turns out that he will probably be participating in more aggressive interactions than before. So what you discover is that he, in fact, is slightly more aggressive, but the deal is that he's still being the same as he was before. He's still judiciously kowtowing to number one and two, but has simply become a total, I don't think I can say this word on the air, to numbers four and five. So it isn't that testosterone is causing the aggression, it may be exaggerating the aggression that's already there, and that brings up the question of whether some of this is societal.
I would say a huge amount of it, and I think if you're an endocrinologist for a living and you think about behavior, what hormones mostly do is make you more or less sensitive to things going on in the environment. I think that's one of the things about testosterone and aggression. I think that's something about the little we understand about the endocrinology of something like premenstrual syndrome. That's certainly what we understand about hormones secreted in response to stress. And what you've got is your classic... there's no biology, there's no environment, there's only the interaction between the two. So if you think that endocrinology is going to teach you that there's a hormonal fix to a societal problem like aggression, that's just not going to happen. And overwhelmingly what testosterone does is make an organism more sensitive to environmental provocations.
To that end, we also find you discussing a little bit or exploring the possibility that some of what we see happening in modern society with early puberty is possibly a combination of effects, one being the possibility that if a child is raised in an unhappy household under a lot of stress and becomes depressed, the eating pattern changes and they become more using food as a medication and relying on more starch and stuff, and they start to have a higher fat percentage on their body, which can lead to an early puberty, which is...
This is one of the essays in there about the onset of puberty called "The Night You Ruined Your Pajamas," which actually is what I wanted to title the entire essay and the entire book, and my editors went crazy over that. No way. Which I still don't understand. But this one picked up on a very controversial theory that popped up about a decade ago from some anthropologists at Penn State University, looking at the supposed finding that girls growing up in unstable households, households in which the father had left or which there was a lot of parental strife, appeared to be reaching puberty at an earlier age. And it was very controversial at the time and has not really panned out. And this essay kind of examined it in part from the standpoint of, my God, where do our bodies get off timing when we reach puberty? And showing that, in fact, there's a whole literature out there, there's all sorts of studies showing things like when you reach puberty and when you time your pregnancy and when you reach menopause and all sorts of things like that are very, very attuned to environmental signals. Our bodies are very careful, machinating machines, keeping track of cost and benefits and all sorts of stuff like that. It's very dynamic biology. Looking at the specific issue, though, of does environmental stress make for an earlier onset of puberty, analyzing this guy's finding and my very sort of subjective opinionated conclusion there was I didn't think much of this effect, and then coming back with one of these themes at the end, and this effect sure is not going to explain inner-city pregnancies amongst 13-year-olds and things like that. Once again, as a biologist, what I can say is, watch it, don't attribute too much to the biology here.
Except that we've also got this issue of environmental estrogens now, pollution, you know, pesticides and chemicals and stuff, which seem to be skewing the hormones a bit. Anyway, you're being quiet, so I'll let you pass on that one. Another one of your...
It's one I don't know much about.
Oh, okay. Well, it's an interesting one. And, I do think that I have seen situations where people with dietary improprieties like high starch, high sugar diets can skew hormonal effects. And in addition, it does seem that there's the rates of young girls getting into precocious puberty seems to be something alarming going on. So,
big effect.
There is. You have another chapter. There is a theme running through this book, but you have another chapter called "How Big Is Yours," which discusses different parts of the brain and how they affect behavior. You talk about a subregion which is central to sexual behavior that is larger in men than women, and that's what you mean, how big is yours. And you mentioned that in homosexual men, it is more like women's. It's a little smaller. But you say nothing about lesbians.
Nobody knew at the time. This was written shortly after this landmark study by a neuroanatomist named Simon LeVay, who's become sort of one of the darlings of the gay community because he found a neuroanatomical difference, a difference in the actual structure of the brain, depending on your sexual orientation. And it wasn't just in any old part of the brain, it was a part of the brain that turned out to be already known to have a lot to do with sexual behavior. And this was a landmark observation, in part because Simon LeVay is very openly gay and a very strong advocate for gay rights, and because he marshaled the view that, look at this, this is ridiculous for anybody on earth to ever do this nonsense again about, oh my God, we can't have gay teachers in the schools, what will they turn our kids into? Look at this, it's biologically based, this is like saying we can't have teachers with blue eyes in our schools, all our kids will get blue eyes. And that has been strongly embraced by the gay community. It's a part of the brain called the sexually dimorphic nucleus, real catchy phrase, and where the gay version of it is smaller than the straight version, and I've seen some t-shirts in the Castro district in San Francisco saying the only small thing about me is my sexually dimorphic nucleus, which I think is great, sort of getting neuroanatomy out on t-shirts there. Your question, though, has anybody looked at a lesbian population? Nobody has, in part because of the tragic source of these gay male brains, which was these were people who died of HIV. And that was the source of the brains, and that's considered to be one of the confounds in the study. The jury definitely remains out as to how consistent this finding of LaVey's is. But the larger context of that essay was one getting at one of the main themes of this book, which is, being gay used to be considered a mental illness. And the American Psychiatric Association managed to have one blowout of a committee meeting somewhere back when and decided it really wasn't a mental illness after all. And, overnight 10 or 20 million people were suddenly cured of a disease, which, was a pretty good outcome for a committee meeting. But this whole shifting as to what counts as a mental illness, what counts as a disease, half the diseases in the sort of Bible of the Psychiatric Association, something called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, half the diseases in there didn't exist 20, 30 years ago. 20, 30 years ago, there weren't even words to describe the way in which somebody's life could be ruined by a gene that was a little bit off or some neurochemistry that was a little bit off in terms of an environmental response. We didn't even have ways to describe it then. Critical question now is, we've got ways to describe it, and there's more and more of them. What's going to happen when all of us have two or three of these labels? And that's a real, real challenging notion.
We've got just about a minute before we go to a brief musical break. This seems like a good time of year to ask this. Why are fevers good?
Because despite making you feel crummy, they make bacteria feel even crummier. Turns out you really have to raise your temperature in order to kill bacteria. And our grandmothers were right about not starving a cold or saving a fever or whatever that one was, but fevers are often actually quite good for you.
Yeah, and you shouldn't starve when you have a fever. You should feed a fever because, no matter what they say, because you're using a lot of energy, huh?
That's what Grandma used to say. Yes, when you are sick and your immune system is kicked into gear, vast, vast increase in your energy needs.
Yeah, so shovel in that chicken soup in great amounts. So fevers are good unless they get up to like 102 or something, and then they start being a little bit bad?
Well, I think it depends on the person's age, but there's a whole bunch of bacteria where raising the temperature slows down the speed at which they divide, and raising your temperature increases the speed with which your immune cells divide.
Okay.
Turns out to be a good thing.
Sounds good to me. All right, we're going to take a brief musical break, and then we will return with our interview with Dr. Robert Sapolsky, author of The Trouble with Testosterone and Other Essays on the Human Predicament, which you can get if you call in and subscribe to your local Pacifica station during this hour. This is Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman with Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm going to take a brief 30-second musical break, give you a chance to dial in either 1-800-HEY-KPFA or 818-985-5735 for KPFK. I'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman, Your Own Health and Fitness, on the phone during this special Pledge Drive show with author of The Trouble with Testosterone and Essays on the Biology of the Human Predicament, Dr. Robert Sapolsky from Stanford. He's a neuroscientist and a biologist with a MacArthur Genius Grant, and he's showing off for us today by phone. And you can get a copy of his book with a special thank you gift from your Pacifica station if you call now and make a pledge during this hour. We're going to go for another 15 minutes or so, and then I'm going to really beg hard for you to do that. So let's talk just a little bit about stress and neurologic damage and the sort of studies. We discussed this before on the show, so I don't want to get stuck here because we have a little more stuff to talk about, but there's an old expression, such and such a person, doesn't get ulcers, he gives ulcers, But in fact, what we discover in your book is that there is a bill for being a bully.
To a certain extent.
I'm thinking of the baboon that you studied, the one that came in and sort of tried to move into number one position a little prematurely.
Well, it turns out this is a case study that got turned into one of the articles in there. Baboon males are sort of at puberty pick up and move to a new troop. This is something you see in all primates. Somebody picks up at puberty and sort of gets ants in the pants and decides they're bored with the old neighborhood and switches over to a different troop. And that's a good way to avoid inbreeding and everybody having six fingers and that sort of thing. And amongst baboons, it happens to be males. In some species, it's females. But the normal picture that you see is one that is just painfully familiar for anybody who went off to college and spent a year being this, you know, terrified peripheral freshman, which is it takes you years to assimilate into a new baboon troop. Except every now and then you get a big, aggressive, cocky kid who comes in, and if instead he's just wildly aggressive, like a house on fire for the next 3 months, he gets a free ride. He rises up in the hierarchy because none of the resident males want to be the first one to, you know, step up to this kid and find out what he's made of. And when you get one of these males who pulls off one of these strategies, it's just enormous misery for everybody in the troop because they're just, you know, disrupting everybody wildly. So this was a couple of years ago in one of the baboon troops that I study out in the Serengeti. We're right in the middle of the season. One of these aggressive transfer males switched in, and what I do is I am able to anesthetize animals in my troop and examine them for ulcers and cholesterol levels and blood pressure.
This is without killing them. You just anesthetize them. Yeah,
exactly. These are baboons I've known for 20 years and knew their mothers and grandmothers.
You just give them a scotch.
Never
mind.
Or a cold version of.
Yeah.
Yes. And everybody's fine the next day. And so I had just studied half the troops. This was a great chance to look at the troop before and after this guy showed up. And, you know, darting animals over the next few weeks and showing that, yes, indeed, he was stressing the bejesus out of everybody. Stress hormone levels were elevated. The immune systems were suppressed in these animals. Classic picture you get of individuals under stress. And about 2 weeks into it, I was able to actually get this guy. And he turned out to have the single most stressed profile I've ever seen in a baboon. He had an immune system that was absolutely suppressed, wild levels of stress hormones. What's the punchline with this guy? Physiologically, it doesn't come cheap being a pain in the neck 12 hours a day.
We knew that. We hoped that. We didn't know that. Do you need a cough break?
Am I allowed to cough on a health and fitness program?
No.
No.
Do you need to get some water or something?
No, I'll just hyperventilate here for a while. Off microphone.
The other thing about stress that's sort of interesting is, I mean, there are a lot of amazing things, but one of the other things that I think we have time to talk about is this idea of repressors. And repressors are people who don't cough on the air. Repressors are people who...
rub it in.
People who look great. You know, you say, how are you? And they say, I'm wonderful. You know, and they're just, you know, they're fine. You know, they're fine. And then what we really discover when we look under the surface is that there's a whole group of people that we can call repressors who report to be fine and are not fine.
Incredibly interesting story. One that's come out over the last few years from some researchers at Vanderbilt in Tennessee, where this was one of the pieces I wrote, which is looking at these folks. And it's been known for a long time. You look at folks who are clearly having a tough time. People with major depression, people with anxiety disorders. And characteristics of those folks is their stress responses are turned on all the time. And that makes perfect sense because a depression is very stressful, anxiety is very stressful, you're always on guard, the world is full of menacing challenges, blah, blah. It makes perfect sense. You look at these folks, though, and you get a big surprise. These are people, by definition, they're not depressed. They're not anxious. They're doing just fine. And in fact, these are the sort of folks you look at them and you say, I wish I could be half this disciplined. And it was suggested to me that this should be called Martha Stewart's disease. These are folks who are incredibly organized. They are on top of everything. There's very sort of detailed personality profiles that show up with these folks of what's called repressive personalities. These are folks who don't like surprises. These are folks who can tell you what they're having for dinner 2 weeks from Wednesday. These are people who have very regimented lives. These are folks who are not good at expressing emotions. These are, and thus the term repressive, these are folks who are not very good at detecting sort of the nuances of emotions in other people. Straight, black and white, lots of rules, everything's under control, and they're happy. They claim they're happy, and you give them, you know, objective tests, and it turns out they're actually happy, and they're doing just fine, and everything's hunky-dory, and you check them out, and they turn out to have incredibly elevated levels of these stress hormones. And it turns out they're more at risk for cardiovascular disease, just like people with type A personality. And this is utterly puzzling. What's the deal here? They're not depressed. They're not anxious. They're happy. They're doing just fine. Why are they so stressed? And I think the answer winds up being they're working incredibly hard at making this world without surprises. And in effect, the other interesting thing that's shown in these folks is their frontal cortex, that part of the brain we talked about before, which is metaphorically like the superego. They have elevated metabolic rates in their frontal cortex. Their frontal cortex is working harder. Metaphorically, these folks are squeezing their sphincter shut all over their bodies all the time. And the punchline is it doesn't come cheap. In effect, it can wind up being extremely stressful to generate a world in which nothing stressful ever occurs. And real interesting with these folks.
Yeah. You know, toward the end of your book, you warn people in the last chapter, not, you might not want to read this chapter if you're really sensitive about religion and stuff like that, but you kind of take on the concept that, like we were talking about at the beginning of the show, that people who are a little skitsy or have a little bit of something can have a certain quality that makes them more, potentially more religious in a certain way. And you kind of go ahead and talk about the possibility that maybe some of the rituals that have developed over centuries in lots of religions may in fact have been originally sort of designed by people with OCD, you know, the sort of do this and then do this and do that. And, you know, it's possible that you're right, and I had mixed feelings about it. I kind of agreed with you in some senses, and then in other ways it occurred to me that the thing about ritual is that when you take someone like me, who, like you, I think doesn't like to wait in line, you know, or, you know, gets, and you tell me that I have to do this thing in a certain way and it has to be done very slowly, it makes me sort of jump out of my skin, but it also, at a certain point, makes me sort of let go and slow down and pay attention. So it becomes, the observance becomes a way to be mindful, to use a term that Buddhists use, or to be careful and conscious. Did you think about that side of it, or?
Absolutely, and I think, you know, ritual does wonderful things for us. And what part of the essay was about was analyzing that there may be more sort of biological reverberations as to why ritual feels good to us than people might initially expect. I mean, what the essay was about, and this was very, very tenuously written because I lecture about this often, and no matter how many caveats you give, people get upset about it, believing that you're saying, oh, being religious is just biological, which is not what I'm saying at all, but analyzing the ways in which certain aspects of theological belief map onto sort of schizotypalism and shamanism, and not just in non-Westernized societies, and this is something people have been writing about for decades, and then analyzing the ways in which certain aspects of religious ritual amongst the Orthodox of many religions has an incredible similarity to the rituals you get with people with obsessive-compulsive disorders. A huge overlap of rituals built around self-cleansing, cleansing of food, preparation of food, numerology, rituals about entering and leaving sanctified places. And people, including Christian theologians, have been writing about this for 500 years, that there's an overlap between the ritualistic needs of individuals who are troubled and the rituals of organized religion. And what I try to do in there is analyze sort of the orthodoxy of all the major religions, and it's incredible. You've got Brahmins washing their hands 6 hours a day in order to follow all the rules, and you've got Orthodox Muslims who have incredibly prescribed rules for how you wash your hands first thing in the morning after relieving yourself, and you have Orthodox Jews with 600 rules or more a day as to what you can do and you can't do, and there's an amazing overlap with obsessive compulsive disorder.
Either that or we're all just really descended from raccoons. That's the other possibility.
The unrecognized route of the evolution.
Yeah, it wasn't primates, it was raccoons. I think in the last 4 minutes, I'd like to close with something that touches you more personally, and it certainly moved me, was your chapter talking about your dad and this whole issue of depression and taking on the traits of lost ones. It would be charming, I think, for you to describe how you said goodbye to your dad after he died.
This is my favorite is the wrong word, but certainly the essay that was emotionally strongest with me.
I should say that it's called The Dissolution of Ego Boundaries and the Fit of My Father's Shirt.
It was an essay that I wrote shortly after my father died a few years ago, and it was one built around the fact that I had some responses which at the time worried me. What's happening to me? Should I go see a therapist? Am I having some odd sort of suspect response here, and one which, with some distance, just had me recognize I was having a very human, very tribal response, and one that we are so alienated from in sort of westernized society these days that as a well-trained scientist, all I could do was smell pathology instead of seeing sort of normative human experience. And this was this process of, in the aftermath and mourning him, of just taking on a bunch of his traits and just finding myself whistling tunes that he used to and viewing the world as he might, and instead of wearing my blue flannel shirts, beginning to wear the blue flannel shirt of his that I had salvaged, and sort of the emotional extreme of it being a final lecture that I was giving to a class of mine during that semester, and one that I was sort of a class I felt fairly attached to, and giving a final lecture there where trying to give them advice about life and sort of basically, you know, letting off steam in this professorial way and that sort of thing, finding that I was basically talking from the perspective of an 80-year-old and giving them the advice that my father would have, and in this weird, and I'm a scientist and not very spiritual, so nothing resembling an out-of-body experience, but just from a very different perspective, I spent the lecture saying goodbye for him. And this whole mixing of egos and this whole melding of boundaries, and all of it was quite confusing to me. It was something he had done in his final years with respect to me, and it was easy for me to attribute it to the fact that he had a dementia at the end, and hooray, there was a pathologic label. And when I did the same thing in return, all I could think of was there's got to be a label for this, and what it is instead is, I think, a very basic part of the human experience, which is this business about being part of something larger than yourself. And what I sort of concluded at the end of the essay, looking at what continuity across generations are like in traditional non-Western societies, and the fact that after a while, it's not that Abraham lived for 900 years, but that in every traditional society there was an Abraham, there were roles that were filled, and just sometimes the person needed to change bodies kind of thing, that when you look at it in that context, there wasn't any pathology here. This was just a basic tribal human experience. And sort of the end of the piece was kind of a lament that it's pretty rare in our westernized society that we can even get a glimmer of being part of something like that. And obviously there's no turning back, and we can't all run around as hunter-gatherers anymore, and being part of something bigger than yourself can as readily have you goose-stepping if you don't watch it. But just for that instant, maybe when you've got the right sort of emotional crisis, you can get just a slight hint of one of the things we don't get in our society anymore. And it was a very strong period for me in terms of discovering that.
I just hope that what you said in your lecture wasn't, when I was your age, I didn't have a car to go to school. I walked barefoot in the snow. I just hope
uphill both ways.
Okay. We have to let you go so we can let people call in and get a copy of your magnificent book, The Trouble with Testosterone. Dr. Robert Sapolsky, neuroscientist and biologist from Stanford University, has been so gracious to spend this hour, 45 minutes with us. We'll have you on again if you can just, you know, get us some more material.
Okay, I'll start writing.
Stay well.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Dr. Robert Sapolsky talking with me about his book, The Trouble with Testosterone, and other essays on the biology of the human predicament.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, or the Progressive Health Observer, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you can listen to the show and an archive all week long. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Dev Ross. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.